It's lunchtime, and Pete Doolin just got back from the Asian store in the city market with supplies for one of his favorite dishes.
I'm going to make stir-fried chicken with red curry and Thai basil.
While the rice is steaming, he slices vegetables, onion, long beans, garlic, and Thai basil.
Thai basil in particular has kind of a anise or licorice flavor to it. A little spiciness, not necessarily heat, but just a little peppery bite on the finish. And it's really aromatic. I love the smell of it also. It's my favorite type of basil.
He learned how to make this dish from his mom, who came to the U.S. from a city just east of Bangkok in Thailand.
When I was a little kid growing up, would do my homework in the afternoons at the kitchen table, and then I would listen to my mom preparing Thai food, and like this was a sound from my childhood, is just chopping up meat or garlic like this. It would just have this nice rhythm to it. Like I always knew when I heard that sound that a meal was coming and it was gonna taste good.
Stir-fry preparation is familiar to many cultures, but this dish is specifically Thai. Every ingredient from the long green beans to the fish sauce is Thai.
You can have these great variations depending on the family and the person that's cooking it, what region it's from.
In food circles, there are a lot of questions about authenticity and appropriation. But as Pete's curry demonstrates, the flavors of world cuisines are complicated. They've taken complicated journeys, authentic journeys, to get where they are today. So what is appropriation and why are we worried about it? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show is all about the politics of food, race, and appropriation on KCUR's Central Standard. Pete Doolin, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you think your curry might help illuminate about this whole debate?
Well, I think in terms of authenticity, I think that word is pretty loaded. And I think in its original sense, it was meant to be like the stamp.
In its authentic sense?
In its authentic sense. That you know, authenticity kind of reflects a genuineness. It's a kind of a stamp of approval of this is what it is. Like if it's you know an authentic brand of a pair of jeans. But I think in terms of food, and particularly with ethnic, quote-unquote, ethnic food, that meaning's evolved to where it's this sense of there's an adventure aspect that's kind of applied to it. So someone that's perhaps non-native that's seeking an authentic Thai meal, they don't just want the real thing. They're also kind of putting they're chasing something. And kind of by saying that it's authentic, whether they know it is or not, they're kind of claiming ownership of that. Like, I know that this is real.
Like that it's their choice to make.
Yeah. It's kind of by saying that it's authentic, I think you kind of claim, you know, domain over that dish because you know more than someone else does if it's authentic or real or not, whether so you actually know.
Seems in a way like tourism, in a sense. Like, I went somewhere, I got a postcard. But in this case, you don't have to go somewhere.
Well, and I think that's the interesting thing. I mean, food is part of culture, and culture is tied to people in a place. So while you can bring back photographs, you can't necessarily bring back this property that you visited, or you can't bring back people that you visited elsewhere, but you can bring back these, you know, memories and experiences of food, and then you find an approximation of that food, say where you live, and then you apply your experience to what you're eating locally, and then you can pronounce whether this is authentic or not.
There's a lot of finger pointing right now around the word appropriation, and I think we'll get into why, but one of the things I think is interesting about that is that it requires so much knowledge of every individual's true background, true story, to know whether that person has an authentic relationship with a food or anything else.
I think that's true, and it's at best, it can be a starting point for a conversation that can build understanding and build connections. But if you don't have that conversation, or if you don't do your homework or your research, then it leaves people turned off, or you know, that are from that culture or have more personal or knowledgeable experience with food in particular, to hear someone else talk about it or present it that may not have that familiarity or understanding of the history and the culture behind it.
Have you ever had that feeling?
Well, it's, I mean, one example, say with Thai food in particular, and this isn't an experience with an individual, but it's an observation. So like when Thai cooking became popular and started growing in popularity commercially, you started seeing Thai spins on foods out there in restaurants. And so you might see a Thai peanut sauce that would pop up on a chicken pizza and be billed as a Thai chicken pizza. And to me, that takes one ingredient within a cuisine, pull it out of context and put it in a completely different context, and then apply the label of Thai to it when there's no connection whatsoever.
Yeah, you wouldn't find a Thai pizza in the kitchen you grew up in.
No, not at all. And, you know, and peanut sauce as an ingredient is very specific in its application. I think the other point with that example is that you are taking one ingredient and you're kind of having that stand in for a representation of Thai food in general, which is incredibly diverse and rich and nuanced.
Yeah, put some peanut sauce on it and it's Thai.
Yeah, just, and you know, it could be salsa or, I mean, frankly, even barbecue sauce, like to throw that on something else. Now, you know, barbecue sauce is a little bit more, it's different because it's not necessarily tied to a culture or ethnicity.
It's a mouthful.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Bon Juingli is with us. He's known as the ulterior epicure, and he's one of the food critics on Central Standard. And Bon Juing, I'm curious about your take. First of all, how would you define the word appropriation?
I think in its clinical sense, I would describe it as taking something, period. It could be anything, appropriation or...
taking something and calling it your own, or just taking it?
I think taking it and assigning it, or assigning probably is better.
Word. What do you mean by that? How would that play out in food, the assigning part?
Well, and to be honest with you, I find this whole discussion of appropriation in food culture quite confusing. I really do. I understand some of the objections that people have to this notion of what I think within the food culture, appropriation has a very specific meaning that may not be, it may be a subset of a more general definition of appropriation, but I find it a little confusing because I kind of find a lot of it, like you said, finger pointing. I find a lot of that just noise. I think for me, the issue here is an understanding or education. And when I think someone is educated about culture or cuisine or attempts to be, I think the more they are, the more they realize that they cannot possibly own it and that perhaps no one can. And so I think that to me is more of the issue here for me. And so I really don't know what to think of appropriate. I think it's just, you know, we live in a society and a generation in a time of labeling. I think it's one label that I understand casts a very wide net for people.
Do you think that our conversations about appropriation have more to do with current trends in food or a political climate or maybe some really interesting combination of the two?
I think it's both. And I think a lot of what's driving this is that our world is shrinking. We have more proximity with other cultures that are very different from our own experiences. And I think that's causing this sort of this not a cultural crisis, but I think we are all having to deal with how do we be respectful of other cultures, but at the same time, reach across and try to understand them.
Well, let's hear a story of how the simmering tension around all of this kind of blew up locally. We're joined now by Josh Eanes. He's been the owner of Happy Gillis for a while. That's a breakfast and lunch spot in Columbus Park where you can get biscuits and gravy or a sandwich or whatever. And recently he opened a second restaurant next door, a ramen shop. But Josh Eanes, as you might guess from the name, is not Japanese. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are you? That was dramatic.
It was dramatic. Thank you for indulging that. Why did you want to open a ramen shop?
Well, for us, when we purchased Happy Gillis, the building came with an attached garage space that we had used for storage and such to get going. But after we had, you know, established ourselves after a year, we realized we had this space and we were, you know, obviously itching to do something new as we always are. And so we just started brainstorming, went through a lot of ideas, and it seemed to make the most sense to, since we already had a kitchen, why don't we just add a second tiny restaurant? And the space just, the best way to say it is it just spoke to us like it was supposed to be a ramen shop, just sort of the grungy, gritty nature of it, the really small space. For us, we felt like that was what we needed, that was what Kansas City did not have, something that we were interested in. Type of food that we like to eat. So we wanted to, I guess, create that for Kansas City. And so that's kind of how it started. And so in a sense, I feel like we kind of did it backwards as we felt like we had this idea of something that was right that we wanted to create, but then we had to go back and figure out, okay, so then how do we create it?
So you didn't just have a passion for ramen or a passion for Japanese culture that started this whole thing?
I guess that's a hard question. I mean, we've always loved Asian ingredients and Japanese ingredients. That being said, I have not been to Japan. I've never worked for, you know, somebody else in a ramen shop and sort of learned that trade over a course of years. But it was something that I feel that we were passionate about wanting to be a part of, for sure.
Can you explain the passion?
I think part of it was the challenge and the opportunity to learn something new. And to sort of figure it out for ourselves and to, I mean, as chefs, we're always wanting to create. And so it's an opportunity to create something new for ourselves, but also for the city.
So with that creating something new, however, there is an existing tradition that, you know, ramen is not globally new. So how did you go about learning what you needed to about ramen traditions in order to work with them?
I think as Banjing was saying about how, you know, how our world is shrinking, like it used to be as chefs, if you wanted to learn something, you would have to go stage at a restaurant or, you know, you would peer in the windows late at night and try to look in, see what you could see. And now I feel like information is at our fingertips, which is both good and a bad thing. So we just started doing research. We traveled, we went to New York City, we ate at, you know, some of the best ramen shops there, took a trip to Chicago. We were part of a ramen festival in Nashville, of all places, where chefs come from all over the country, which was a fun experience. And so we just kind of immersed ourselves, read a lot. And then we also just experimented on our own. And I feel like in Japanese cuisine in general, everything is very regimented and very traditional, but I feel like ramen in particular lends itself to being more of this renegade cuisine. It's sort of like the rebels who there aren't really rules. It's sort of every chef has their own voice and their own flavor. And so every shop is different, just as it's different in every region. But then within that, every chef kind of has their own thing.
Is that true in both Japan and the United States? Or is that a particular like 21st century American ramen shop thing? You know what I'm saying?
I feel like it started that. I mean, even in Japan, ramen is a very young cuisine. I mean, it's been around about 100 years. And even there where it started, it was the Japanese chef who kind of wrapping the towel around his head, you know, and just sort of doing his own thing. And so I think even the spirit of it in Japan is that everyone is kind of doing their own thing. And I feel like that translates to what we're doing here is we're sort of figuring it out for ourselves. So I like to say that we're trying to figure out what it means to make ramen in Kansas City.
I have to say, I'm a little surprised that there is such a thing as a ramen festival, which might make me incredibly naive. There are festivals for a lot of things, but I'm still surprised to hear about your attendance at a ramen festival.
In Nashville, too, of all places. So we did a Kickstarter for our ramen shop, and there's a lady there named Sarah Gavigan who has a great ramen shop, and she got a notification about our Kickstarter during our campaign, so she actually reached out to us and said for her contribution, she wanted to invite us down and have us work the festival and meet people, which was actually a great experience.
Is there anything in the process of doing this that you learned about ramen that really appealed to you and fascinated you in some way?
There's a lot of things. I mean, I think specifically, there's a certain broth called tonkotsu, which is a really rich, creamy pork broth that's cooked for a long time. We cooked ours for about 30 hours. And for me, because I was trained classical French, and so everything is very clean, precise, and I guess more delicate in approach.
What do you mean by clean?
Well, in particular to this would be like stock making. Like say you're making a classical French stock, it's very clean. You want to skim, you want it to be very clear, etc.
The broth itself to be clear.
Yes.
Okay.
It's all about the precision, whereas tonkotsu kind of takes that on its head, and it's a broth that you actually rigorously boil nonstop for 30 hours, and it creates this emulsified, rich, like pure porky broth that for me was just kind of a revelation because it's actually the opposite of what Western chefs try to do. And so to me, that was just a really interesting thing when we were first learning how to make it.
And that you can see sort of the parts that compose it?
Well, just the way you achieve the end product to me was the opposite of, like, for the first time we made it, it went against everything that I had been ingrained in me on the way to do it. So it was like, it was almost hard to do it because it felt wrong, if that makes sense, because it was just the opposite. So it just opens your eyes to how things can be so different.
So when you opened the shop, I mean, how did you apply the things you had learned within your ramen restaurant?
Well, for us, I feel like what we do at the shop is an interesting blend between traditional ramen techniques, but also our training, being trained in fine dining, French cuisine, but also having access to our local ingredients. I feel like we try to merge that sort of fine dining sensibility with a ramen shop. People would call that chef-driven or artisanal ramen or whatever you want to call it, but I feel like that's kind of we try to play to our strength and be true to who we are in the ramen.
So when you opened, there was a little bit of a backlash.
Oh, sure. I mean, I feel like anytime you put yourself out there in the public eye, there's positive and then there's also negative. We had backlash from just the fact that we were doing a Kickstarter. People took that personally, which was really interesting to me, the fact that people saw that as a negative, that we weren't doing it the right way. You know, we weren't borrowing a bunch of money from a bank like their grandfather did or whatever the story might be. So we got backlash just the fact that we were doing a Kickstarter. And then I feel like after we've opened, there's been a lot of, like we discussed before, the use of the word authentic. And I guess that's my biggest beef is just the use of that word, I feel like is so limiting to what food is and to what food can be. But what I try to tell people is that food is a living and breathing thing because it's a part of culture, right? So this idea that food is stuck in time or that it's static, I feel like is really sad because as chefs, we're always trying to push and to create and to be a part of something new. And I feel like that attitude stifles that creativity, which is what we're trying to do to push our culture here, specifically in Kansas City, forward. How can we be better?
Yeah, I mean, hear you. Do you mind if I challenge you just a little bit here?
Sure.
Because some people might hear this idea that fine dining associated with French cuisine on one end and that there's authentic ramen on the other, that these two things are somehow different, that like there's a scale where one is fine and the other might be associated with words like grungy or gritty. the words that you use to describe the shop, that people might hear in that some kind of, I don't know, like that there's a scale.
Sure. I would say for me, my background being in fine dining, I feel like I got to a point to where I had enough of that. And part of us leaving that world, you know, from the American restaurant to buying Happy Gillis was us making a choice for where we wanted to expend our time. And also, it was also a family choice, having young kids. And so I would say, I hear what you're saying, but I don't consider myself a fine dining chef anymore. I want to be somebody that can actually feed people and connect with them. Not that you can't do that in fine dining. It's not what I'm trying to say, but be more accessible. Do good food on an accessible level and touch people's lives. So I hear what you're saying, but I don't think of myself as a fine dining chef.
Well, what the thing that I hear here, the tension I think that I have identified in a lot of this talk about food culture and appropriation, is I think for a lot of people it boils down to a sensitivity about classism. And it's a socioeconomic sort of tension more than a cultural tension. I think a lot of people recognize and acknowledge that, okay, you know, we are all from different cultures. We can learn from each other. And it's not that, you know, a chef from Thailand can't make Mexican food or that a French chef can't make Vietnamese food. It's more about, you know, I've read a lot of articles recently about the objection to the fact that, well, certain races and classes have more access to money, which enables them to open restaurants that are able to, you know, they get more audience or they are able to disseminate. You know, one of the most famous chefs in the United States, Rick Bayless, who has a very successful restaurant group in Chicago, and he has an encyclopedic knowledge of Mexican cuisine, truly, and yet he has been, you know, questioned about that. Well, don't you admit that you have more privilege because you are a white male who grew up in the United States? You were able to go to Mexico when you were a teenager to indulge your interests in Mexican cuisine, that your parents were able to afford all this. And a lot of people gave him a lot of grief because he wasn't willing to acknowledge that that had much to do with anything. And he focused more about his knowledge of the cuisine. And I think, you know, a lot of people had laughed at him because he had sort of said that, you know, he felt that there was a little bit of reverse discrimination there or reverse racism, and people laughed that off and thought that was absurd. But at the same time, if he's not willing to, you know, acknowledge that, then why can't they acknowledge the fact that he also has earned his creds, that he has spent a lot of time in Mexico? He knows Mexican cuisine better than, you know, a lot of Mexicans do. You know, you have a lot of these people. Diane Kennedy is on also encyclopedic. You have Fuchsia Dunlop, whose encyclopedic knowledge of Chinese cuisine, regional cuisine. And I think a lot of these people do have to deserve credit for that. But I think the thing that causes people to get really worked up is this socioeconomic thing that you're identifying here with asking this question about why is fine dining associated? You know, those words
right,
access, are loaded, right?
Access to not only the knowledge, but then the audience for it commercially.
Correct. And why is it that when you say fine dining, you know what that is? It's French, it's white tablecloths, it's candles, it's white glove service.
And an expectation about how much you pay for those two
correct.
Different kinds of cuisines.
Right.
You
and there's
pay
that
a
socioeconomic
lot for
French, right,
and
correct.
You get a good deal on
that's
Mexican
right.
food.
That's right. And I think that's where the tension comes. I don't necessarily see it that way. I'm not that sensitive to that because I also see a lot of chefs in a lot of different cultures do take advantage of this. I mean, that's just capitalism. I mean, that's just economic advantage. But it's not necessarily doesn't make it right. But as long as I think people are aware, I think for me, the biggest key to all this is education.
Pete, jump in.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, like, say if you're a French-trained chef, that people, if you're not born in France, that there is this uproar over you're using French, you know, techniques or, you know, a French style that you're adapting to your own. Whereas if you're taking, you know, ramen or Mexican food or Thai food or whatever cuisine that may not have the same cachet or history, that there's controversy over that. And to me, it's like, well, why are you not upset that an American chef is using classic French techniques or perhaps even, you know, German or some other Western European techniques? and there's no controversy over that versus someone that's learning how to make ramen or Mexican food. And I think part of that goes back to that the issue over class
and race.
And race and the socioeconomic status of where that food lies.
But I also think that it's sort of like, where do you draw the line of, you can't have it both ways, right? I mean, you want authentic, and if you were to go to Asia, you're not going to find white tablecloth and candelabras. That's just not a part of that culture. And so I think it would be unfair to expect that. The question is why cannot they break that ceiling elsewhere? Well, that's maybe a fair question. But then you have chefs like David Chang, who's Korean, but he's most known for cooking ramen, Japanese cuisine. No one questions that. Is it because he has an Asian face? He also sells his ramen at a much higher price than most ramen shops. So no one also jumps up and down about that. People flock to his restaurants. And you have Danny Bowen, who's a Korean-born chef, adopted by white parents in Oklahoma. And he's cooking Sichuan Chinese, admission Chinese in San Francisco and New York, and wildly successful. But no one questions him on that. So...
Well, we're going to take a break. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, why Zaid Consuegra objects to your horchata drink. You're listening to an encore broadcast of KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today KCUR's Central Standard is all about food, race, and appropriation. We're going to talk now with Zaid Consuegra, with us from Pirate's Bone, a coffee shop and eatery on 59th Street near Brookside. Hi, Zaid.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Pretty good.
So, I mentioned before that you've got something to say about horchata, and we're going to get to that, but I don't want to leave people hanging too long. So let's talk quickly about your family and your background.
Yeah, so first of all, you're missing out on this, whoever's not on the station. This is a great conversation inside the room. There's a lot to talk about. So let's start off. I was born in Mexico City, and I grew up there until I was 11, and then I was brought here. My mom's side is Mexican-Spanish, and my dad's side is Mexican-Italian, I believe. So all of my food has mainly been all my food background has been Mexican cuisine.
And your mom has some restaurant experience that you grew up with, right?
Yeah, so I grew up in the food industry and a whole bunch of other things. But my mom had a small restaurant when we were in Mexico. And I come from a lower class, per se. So I used to... I was always hustling. I was always selling. So whenever she'd go to the market for the food, I would grab candy bags and I would bring them to school and I would sell them at school. So I was always been in the business. But yeah, I had when I was young. My mom had a very small restaurant when I was young. And then when we moved to Kansas, later around high school is when we opened a restaurant in the Overland Park area.
And so how did you see, I guess, like white Midwesterners responding to the food that your mom was selling there in a different time period?
Yeah, different times. And we mostly cater to the immigrant community. So our food was what you would call authentic. And that word is loaded with so much. But in my life, I think there is some weight to it. I think we were proud of saying that it was authentic food, and I think we could call it authentic. One, because you couldn't find a white person working in our restaurant. And it wasn't because we didn't want to, it's just because no one came and applied. And we were catering to all immigrants. So our food was food driven from recipes from Mexico. Nothing was hard shell. It was just Mexican food. And I think that's where I agree with the word being used in a
with what word being used?
Authentic. I think that's where you can use authentic.
It's about who's making it and who's eating it?
I think there's a what, when, where, and why question behind it. So it goes very deep. And I do agree with, you know, food being played with and not stopping food and keeping it stale just because it's traditional. I do believe in being creative with food. But at that point, I don't think you should be able to use the word authentic. I think you should just say, you know, like ramen shop, but it's not an authentic ramen shop. Maybe it's just like his ramen shop. It's his style of ramen. But I think I would be maybe upset if he was throwing, not upset. I think I would just see it a little wrong if he said barbecue chicken ramen and call it authentic barbecue chicken ramen when there is no authentic barbecue chicken ramen. Or with the pizza, you know, if there was a Thai chicken peanut pizza, authentic. I think that's where I have a problem. When people label something authentic that isn't authentic.
What does authenticity mean to you? Not as in a definition, but what does it mean, like, personally and emotionally to you?
Personally, I think it has to come from the original source.
But I guess I'm curious, why does authenticity matter to you?
One, because I think if we don't keep authenticity, we start to lose the culture it comes from. I think, you know, let's talk about tacos, per se, because of my background. I was shocked to find hard shell tacos here. When I came to the States, I was really shocked by burritos because I didn't know what burritos were. But yet Chipotle is called a Mexican grill, which I find hard to believe because never in the 11 years that I was in Mexico City did I ever see a Chipotle like anything.
Was it in part that this is sort of like they're not just purveying food, they're purveying an understanding of what your culture is?
Yeah, and I think when Americans see, and I've had this happen, so when Americans see something that they're not used to, let's just stick with tacos, they come into this quote-unquote authentic Mexican restaurant and they see hard shell tacos and they go for it. Now they have an idea of what a taco should be like, even though that's not what it should be like, even though that's not an authentic taco. But then they go to an authentic Mexican restaurant and they ask for tacos and they get shell-shocked when they get soft tacos.
Shell-shocked.
Yeah. And they want authentic. They ask for authentic tacos. So, and really what they're asking for is a hard shell taco that is nowhere near authentic. So I think labeling does come very important.
What do you think about the trend toward calling what might be closer to a quote-unquote authentic taco a street taco?
I had a laugh with this with Jed. I don't know what a street taco is. And people have this huge thing about street tacos that I'm not getting. I knew tacos as tacos. That's as easy as it comes. When people say, hey, let's go get tacos, we're going to go get tacos. And that means a corn tortilla with some form of meat or vegetable, and that's it. Lettuce. I mean, I'm sorry, not lettuce. Sorry. cilantro or onions, and then you add the rest. But now you have this new wave of people who think street tacos is authentic, and it's a thing. And to me, it could come off as a put down on what I used to know as a taco or authentic food from my culture.
The idea that it would come from the street?
The idea that, yeah, we have to, and there was tacos that I ate from the street and they were still called tacos. I never once called them street tacos. So I think it's more of, I think it does lower the class of
restaurant
food.
French.
Yeah, I would never see a street taco in a French restaurant because of the word. You lower the class of what it is.
I think part of that, these examples, is that you take something out of its cultural context and into a commercial application, say Chipotle, and then you start commodifying not only the food, but an aspect of the culture also.
That's totally correct.
But see, I'm not bothered by that. Maybe I'm just not, maybe I just have thick skin. But, you know, imagine my parents' shock when they came to the United States in the late 60s, early 70s and found fortune cookies and crab rangoons at Chinese restaurants. And people would order a plate of food and sit down and eat the whole thing instead of sharing it family style like they would, right? But, you know, I just got back from Mexico City literally last week. And I think, you know, the Mexicans are having fun with it too, because now they're throwing it back. If you go to a taqueria in Mexico now, you'll find tacos gringos on the menu, and that's literally what we as Americans think of hard shell taco with your lettuce and your ground cheese on there, you know, all that stuff. But also this question of authenticity, you know, having traveled throughout Mexico a lot, you know, I was in Oaxaca once, and it sort of dawned on me that what's authentic to this Oaxacana grandmother that was cooking this mole for us, she was like, you have to understand that when you talk about Mexican cuisine, what's authentic? Because you have to realize that there's pre-Hispanic food that existed here for centuries before the Europeans came and introduced a different type of cooking. And so what is authentic to you as a Mexican may not be authentic to all Mexicans because of their experiences. There are mestizos, and then there are people who are still very much indigenous to the land of Mexico. And so I think that, you know, that is why I think the term authentic is so loaded.
It is. And I do agree. Like in Mexico City, it's pretty much the New York City of Mexico, where everything from the country just slops, or like it's slapped down. And for some reason, we're kind of tucked away from the northern side, so we don't know much about the northern side. Like the music is totally different, the food is so different, culture is different, and same with the southern border of Mexico. Mexico City has its own thing. It's weird. And I think I'm not opposed to changes like the gringo tacos. I think it's great. And they're labeling it as a different taco. And I think that's what we should do. I think we should say, hey, this is this. And not...
It's a problem with language.
Yeah. And labeling. So I think if we're going to be ingenious and recreate foods in our own way, we should label it as such.
Can I say something, though? I want to know, before we get too deep into this, you know, what's the deal with horchata?
Okay, so I don't know. I know that horchata is in Mexican. I know that. It's a long history.
And this is a rice milk
this
drink.
This is a rice milk drink. For me, it's made with rice milk, sugar, cinnamon, and vanilla. But I read about it a long time ago, and it comes from everywhere. There's a whole bunch of nations that do this drink. But I was thrown off when I made the horchata at the shop, and then I just added a shot of espresso. So we call it dirty horchata at the Pirate's Bone. And that's one of the things. I didn't want to call it just horchata, here you go, when it's not horchata. It's totally different. But I was more shocked when I saw it at... local chain of coffee, and I knew what products went in, so it's a syrup that you could just get at any store that is probably like the cheapest, worst tasting thing in the world, and they threw it on here, and it was just kind of like slapped on, like, oh, here's our new drink, boof, try it, because we're a big name brand, so you should just buy it.
Well, this maybe brings us back to the question of class. I mean, what offends you about that? Can you put your finger on it? Because it sounds like the fact that it's a big chain is part of what bothers you about it.
I think class does come in, and race especially comes in into play. And I know it's something that is very touchy, and a lot of people don't want to deal with, because it's a long conversation when we go into race. But like we were talking about, I think our world just got a lot smaller. And I think we have to start talking about race, because
wait. I want to understand what bothers you about the drink really specifically. So it's because it sounds like you were saying that it's not, that horchata is not a Mexican drink specifically. But was it being promoted that way? Is that part of what was bothering
there
you?
There was a a festive look to their marketing campaign, which I get upset at every restaurant that does this, because now everyone wants, you know, chips and salsas, and they want this Americanized Mexican food. So when I saw this marketing for horchata being sold at this coffee shop, I was upset because of how they marketed it, because they marketed it as festive and cultural, and I doubt that anyone knew what it was or had any background.
Well, KCUR Central Standard is going to be right back. We're going to finish up this conversation about appropriation, and you have just a little time to weigh in. We've been revisiting a favorite conversation on KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with KCUR Central Standard and a room full of wonderful guests. We've got Pete Doolin and Bonjuing Lee, who are both food critics with us here on Central Standard. We've got Josh Eanes, the owner of the Columbus Park Ramen Shop, as well as Happy Gillis, and Zaid Consuegra with us from Pirate's Bone. We are talking about food, race, and appropriation, also class, it turns out, more than anticipated on this show today. And we're ready to talk with you in just a moment. But one thing that we haven't really addressed is maybe what's going on culturally in the United States, in food, that makes people want to reach across time and space for ingredients or processes or some kind of food tradition other than the one that is, quote unquote, their own. Because I think there might be something important in that, you know, like maybe just a reaction against a culture where for a while there were trends in food without a lot of love, without a lot of time and care. And maybe people, I don't know, find that by looking somewhere else, they can find a relationship with food that appeals to them more. Is that valid, do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
I think deliciousness is universal. And so I think the realization of that is what's causing all of us to suddenly be excited about finding other ways of deliciousness.
Yeah. Food is social by nature. And I think if you can bond together with other people, whether you're foodies or you just happen to find someone that has similar interests, that's exciting. And having that discussion and sharing what you're making at home, or say you find a restaurant that you're really excited about, is a good thing to foster that conversation. And hopefully you're learning more about that food and that culture as a byproduct.
Do you have to be a little bit more careful, do you think, if you are doing this in a public for-profit kind of way, because it could be seen that you are profiting from a stereotype of another culture, or just, I don't know, some cachet of exoticism?
I think so. I think if you're a business, I think you have to be careful and be ready. Be ready for the backlash, and 'cause you will have it. Whichever way you do it, we've seen it with Columbus Park.
Yeah.
So I think as long as you're ready and you know that you might get some people upset, then you're good for it.
Josh,
I think the important key here is for me as a business operator, you know, we've been talking about the word authentic, and all of the, for us in our experience, all of that labeling has come from the outside directed to us, and it hasn't been something that we've projected. So I never came out of the scene saying, we're opening an authentic Japanese style ramen shop in Kansas City. And I never said that, but so that labeling comes from the outside.
Who labeled it from the outside? Like critics or?
Everybody with a Yelp account. don't even get me started on that.
I think there's a danger in over-fetishizing the other. No one likes that. But at the same time, I think we as consumers in the public shouldn't walk around like eggshell plaintiffs all the time, waiting to be hurt by someone else's, you know, thing too. So
I think part of that labeling also from the outside is are people trying to take ownership again of like what's authentic or what's real. And so applying that label and making a pronouncement is not so much about you, but about them making themselves an authority, whether they are or not.
Let's go ahead. Let's talk to Emily in Kansas City. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
What can you share?
Well, I just kind of wanted to share, like, the importance of authenticity. I think, well, for me, I'm Japanese American, and my boyfriend is Japanese, and he's a lover of ramen. He actually worked at a couple ramen shops, and he just follows all these ramen critics. And so when Columbus Park opened, we were very excited, but we did notice that it was authentic, right? And
wait, you noticed what? I'm sorry, it broke up a little bit.
Oh, we noticed that it wasn't authentic.
Wasn't.
When we, it wasn't. And I understand even the owner kind of accepts that. But I think it was kind of sad when we ordered tonkotsu ramen, we were corrected that it was tonkatsu, which is cutlet. I thought that was kind of an interesting point. I know that maybe it changed since then. But I think the importance is education and knowing the basics and the history and the culture of ramen, because it has a big, it's like its own culture. And I think it's just really important to know the basics. I don't know. I just kind of want to portray that. But,
so wait, were you saying that you were corrected on the pronunciation of the dish?
Yeah. We were.
Josh, does that surprise you?
Yeah, I'm really sorry to hear that, and I would like to apologize. That's just a staff education thing that I apologize that happened, but I'm really grateful that you came in and tried our shop.
Emily, mm-hmm. when you have an experience like that, though, to help, I mean, we just heard this reference to, like, what was it, eggshell consumers?
An eggshell plaintiff. It's eggshell a legal term.
Sorry,
law school stuff. Yeah.
but, you know, like, can you help people who haven't maybe had an experience like that understand how it made you feel?
Mm-hmm. I think, well, we obviously went really excited, and we were expecting a lot. So we kind of went with more expectations. But, I mean, there are people here that I've brought friends and taken them to ramen shops around here, and they say they love it, but I know that it's not the authentic food. I don't know. It's kind of interesting. I think it's just really important to know the basics of food. Fine dining, maybe that's French cuisine and knowing the French techniques, but ramen is its own technique. There's its own, like, respect in that and its own lifestyle, I guess.
Emily, I have a question for you. So, for example, if you were to go to a restaurant like Chipotle or to P.F. Chang's, though, do you as a consumer, are you aware that those are not authentic Chinese and Mexican restaurants?
Yes, I am very aware that it's not authentic.
Right.
I went to college in Los Angeles, and I've been told, like, you know, let's be real, burritos are not.
Right, and I think what you're saying there, which I really very much identify with, is that education really is everything. It really is, yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's important to know that, and then you can, like, proceed and appreciate that food its own way. Like, Chipotle, yeah, it's great, but we know that it's not Mexican. I think it's important to know that, too.
Is part of it, I mean, I guess I wonder whether it's not always preferable to be asked a question about yourself and your own culture as opposed to presented something by someone else being like, this is what you are. I mean, that just feels bad.
Yeah, but I think at the same time, it's also incumbent upon us to recognize when they're not doing that. When they're saying, this is my experience with ramen, and this is my expression of it, but it's not necessarily yours, right? And I think what Josh is saying is that he never presented his ramen that way, and I'm totally fine with that.
Jump in, Josh.
The real question is it delicious? Yes. You know, is it delicious? Do you enjoy it? Not everybody's going to think our ramen is delicious, but thankfully there's enough people that do that we can still continue to serve it.
Josh Eanes of Happy Gillis and Columbus Park Ramen Shop, thank you. And thank you to Bonjwing Lee, Pete Doolin, and Zaid Consuegra. Great guests, great conversation. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
To listen back to this encore presentation or any favorite shows you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/Central Standard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there and stay current on our news by following us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.